You're listening to All Things Trek with DJ Bob and DJ Warren. Music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturdays from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific. That's 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern on riserradio.com.
Hello, hello once again, folks. You're here listening to All Things Trek. It is 4 p.m. in the west, 7 p.m. in the east, midnight across the pond in the Atlantic. I hear there's other time zones out there.
You know, I heard about that. It's about railroads, trust me. Railroad conspiracy for time.
Well, you gotta make sure everyone's on time, though, when they're going places and doing stuff.
You do, but there were time riots when they first instituted that.
Time riots?
Time riots, but that's not what we're here to talk about today.
Well, what do you want to talk about then? You know, I want to talk about your Pokemon journey that you're doing afterwards. You know, because you're such a nerd.
You know, now you had to tell everyone about that.
I did.
I'm doing a Pokemon tournament afterwards, and if any one of my friends who is going to be in the tournament is listening to us right now, they can benefit, because I'm going to lead with Moltres.
Moltres.
So, you know, hit me with a rock move and I will wilt.
All right, I don't know anything about this Pokemon business. Welcome, folks. You're listening to All Things Trek here on Rise Radio. You can join us in the IRC chat for all sorts of interactivity and talking to the show. Unfortunately, we don't have a Star Trek Online presence at the moment because we're ultra noob like that. I am trying to set up a, what's it called, Pigeon?
Pigeon? Yeah, I think that's the client we're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, I have the client. I'm trying to set up the XMPP thingamajigger, but it doesn't seem to want to work.
The internet is broken.
The internet is broken. So if any of you can fix the internet, please send me an email at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. You can also interact with the show that way as well. If you want to send us an email, tell us how awesome or bad we're doing. If you totally disagree with us, that's the way to do it, or through the IRC. Contact through the IRC. Make sure you go to the website, riserradio.com. Go to the community tab. Go down to IRC. You can join in right through there. I am there, in there. Oren's in there, as he's right here next to me.
This is true.
We are broadcasting like that because we're awesome like that. So did you hear about the contest we got going on right now for Las Vegas?
You know, I heard about it, but tell me the details.
Oh, man. All right. So what you do, go to riserradio.com.
Uh-huh.
Donate. It doesn't matter how much you donate.
Right.
I just don't believe it is. Roxy, if you want to give me some information on that about how much we need to donate. I don't think it's actually any set amounts, anything like that. But if you do, you'll be entered in a chance to win some tickets to go to Las Vegas Convention. It's going on there for Star Trek. And you also have a chance to, with that, have dinner with Xander, Roxy, and Tosk, and dinner will be on them.
That's rad.
It was rad. I wish I could go.
I want to have dinner
with those guys. I do want to. So do I. Unfortunately, we have business to attend to.
It's true.
You're doing important stuff like broadcasting, All Things Trek.
And Pokemon tournaments.
That's right. All right. So, what do we got lined up today, Warren?
All right. Well, today we are going to talk about the female characters of Star Trek.
Because
particularly, we're going to limit it to main cast members for time's sake, and we may still not get through all of them. But Star Trek has a bit of a checkered history with its female characters, and so we're going to talk about that a little. And at about the half-hour break, we are going to play for you the first episode of Tales from the DMZ, which is a radio play.
Well, at the top of the hour, not the half-hour break.
Yeah, excuse me, at the top of the hour break.
No false hope for you guys out there.
But we will play the first episode of Tales from the DMZ, and you will all enjoy it.
It's pretty rad. We got some pretty good voice actors in there, especially the Cardassian Gul Padar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh man,
Gul Padar.
He did a fantastic job.
Played by my very good friend Graham Swanson, who I hope is listening to this. But yes, he does an amazing Cardassian.
So, Graham, you rock so hard. You should do some voice acting.
He should.
Oh man, he's doing voice acting.
He is, but he needs to do more voice acting.
This is true. Sorry, right. who are we going to talk about first?
All right, well, first, we're going to start with the original series and the lady who started it all, and that's Uhura, played by Nichelle Nichols.
Mm-hmm.
But first, something you have to understand about the original series is that it was originally supposed to be much more progressive in terms of gender equality. For anyone who's seen The Cage, which was the original pilot, you will know that there was a female first officer.
That was played by Majel Barrett,
yes,
right?
That was played by Majel Barrett, Gene Roddenberry's wife. And she was pretty cool, and she knew what she was doing. She was competent. And most notably, she wore pants, as did most of the female crew members. A few of them still had the miniskirt thing going on, but most of them wore pants. And then,
was there any other episode where they wore pants, or did they all just switch to the skirts after that?
They switched to the skirts pretty much all after the second pilot. In the second pilot, that they made after The Cage, you could still see occasional women wearing pants, but most of them are wearing skirts at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just went fully converted. But basically, the networks told Roddenberry that if he wanted to make his show, he had to lose the female first officer, and that he had to, you know, put the ladies in something sexier. And he either could do that, or he could lose Spock. That was what the networks told him.
And obviously we have Spock.
Yeah. And so Gene Roddenberry decided to keep Spock.
Which is a shame. I think Majel Barrett would have done a really good job being that strong number one character like
that.
Yeah,
she really would have. And I really would have liked to see that. But she didn't end up being on the show. Instead, we have...
That was Nurse Chapel.
She became Nurse Chapel, also the voice of the computer. And Michelle Barrett is rad. I like Michelle Barrett. But in this instance, we are speaking of Uhura, who first appeared in the second pilot, known as the Corbite Maneuver. And she was also notable for being an African-American on television, which was not terribly common in the 60s, and when African-American...
Not only African-American, African-American with an actual applicable job.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the... You know, Uhura is good in some areas. She's very good in that she has a real job, and she has an actual rank. She is a lieutenant. You know, she's not there to clean up and sweep the floors, which is actually... there's a quote from Whoopi Goldberg when she was watching the original series. And she was, like, a little kid at the time, and she ran to her mom and was like, "Mommy, Mommy, there's a black lady on TV, and she's not someone's maid." And it was like, you know, so for
that was stereotypical at the time
It was. And this was the 60s, and the 60s were full of horrible stereotypes. Not to say that we don't have them today, but we have, at least to some extent, grown out of the problems we had in the 60s. So that was one of the things that Uhura was good for. And then she also has a couple of really good episodes, particularly Mirror, Mirror, the episode where they go into the Mirror Universe. Their entire plan for getting back hinges on Uhura.
Oh man, did that use the transporter?
It did use the transporter, which any of you from last week will remember we talked about, and this was one of the good uses of the transporter.
So much.
I don't hate the transporter, but this was one of the good uses of the transporter. Put them in a situation that they weren't prepared to deal with, and then they had to deal with it. And that their entire plan for getting out of the Mirror Universe was dependent on Uhura. And Uhura actually had to, you know, actually had to come through for them and had to be an integral part of what was going on as opposed to just an observer. That was also the episode where we found out that Uhura is literally a strong woman character, because Uhura, the only difference between the alternate universe uniforms and the regular universe uniforms is that the females
have
the midriff of their uniform deleted. So you can see their tummies. And Uhura's tummy is full of six-pack. And you can also the sleeves are shorter.
Well-defined.
And you can see that her arms are also very muscular. And it's like, so, you know, apparently Uhura can rip you in half. And, like, really the only person on the original series cast more toned than Uhura was Sulu. So, you know, if nothing else, she was a literal strong woman character. Even if a lot of the time that wasn't actually what ended up happening. Because even though the original series was very progressive in terms of racial equality, they did not do gender equality very well. There are actually a number of episodes that Uhura isn't even in because they are so anti-woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like Mud's Women, which is the episode that for some reason decided to introduce Harvey Mudd as a reoccurring character.
Now, what do you mean by anti-woman?
I'm getting to that, actually.
Uh-huh.
I'm getting it. So Mudd's Women was an episode that basically they ran into this guy who was this, like, kind of smarmy, annoying traitor. He's like the outrageous
Okana. The used car salesman
of
the universe.
Yeah, the used car salesman of the universe. And his cargo was that he was smuggling women around. And that on its own sounds kind of interesting. But then he started, like, the entire point of the episode is about this, like, magic pill that they have that, like, makes women attractive. Basically the message of the episode was that women are incredibly insecure and need makeup to feel better about themselves. And, like, it was just, watching it was just so goofy. Like, I talked with my mother about it, and she is a professor of women's studies at the University of Hawaii, and she watched that episode when it first aired.
Uh-huh.
And even during the 60s, that episode was kind of, that episode was
distasteful.
Sort of weird and didn't really fit with the rest of the show and what it was about. And Uhura isn't in that episode, because Uhura doesn't really have any place in that episode. She's also not in the last episode of Star Trek, the original series, which was Turnabout Intruder, which was an episode where they actually established that women are not allowed to be captains in Starfleet.
Really?
Really. They established that. And granted, it was said by a character who we later find out was kind of crazy, so maybe that was wrong. But no one corrects her when she says it. So maybe, like, you know, it's not 100%, but it seems pretty likely that that was the intent. And again, the episode is about how a woman takes over Kirk's body but by nature of her femininity cannot maintain command of the ship and goes insane. And, like, and you know, then the rest of the crew has to figure out that Kirk's been possessed.
Dang, that is pretty sexist.
It really is. It's not a good episode. It is one of the original series' low points, and I'm really sad that that was what the original series ended on.
The message clear-cut, then, in that episode was supposed to be, because she's a woman, she can't handle the responsibility of command.
Yeah, that was basically the...
It wasn't because her as a character was incompetent?
No, they... At first, I thought that was the thing, but they have a lot of lines where she is, like... You know, where they talk about the weakness of femininity, and how, like, you know, she isn't good enough, and they constantly refer to the fact that she's a woman. And I don't think they ever come right out and say women can't be good command officers, but that is clearly the intent. And, like, I've watched this episode several times because I was hoping to find some kind of deeper meaning, and I can't find one. And I do not know what the point of this episode was. It doesn't even end the series very well.
Well, they got canceled, though.
Well, they did, but they knew they were going to cancel it at that point. They could have written a better conclusion episode than that. This was at the end of the third season.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is. Especially when you compare that to the Enterprise incident, which has the Romulan commander, who is a really rad female character and has a really great romance with Spock. And that episode, the Enterprise episode, is a really good episode of Star Trek. In my opinion, it's my favorite of the original series. But
what made her a strong character, the Romulan commander?
The Romulan commander was a strong character because she was good at her job. She had a goal. She had motivation. She had an actual character that we could understand. She had flaws. She wasn't perfect. She gets fooled by them. Mm-hmm. But she was clearly, you know, a worthy adversary. In the same way that, like, Khan is a worthy adversary in Wrath of Khan and in the first episode that Khan appears in Space Seed. And that was what made her a good character. But then Uhura isn't in Turnabout Intruder because that episode is so anti-woman that it would have been really awkward for her to be there. And in fact, I actually could believe that Nichelle Nichols didn't want to be in that episode, because Nichelle Nichols is a really rad person and is a great actress. And she was actually thinking of leaving Star Trek because she didn't really feel like her character was going anywhere.
Oh, I know this story. Yeah. And then Martin Luther King actually came to her and said, "Don't do it. You're actually doing so much for us by portraying an African-American woman with actual responsibility on TV."
Yeah, and so she decided to stay with the show, and it's a good thing that she did. She does provide, you know, one of the firsts in sci-fi and in television in general. But then they have a bunch of times, like, Uhura, of all the crew members, Uhura is depicted as being the worst at her job. Like, she's not awful at it, but if you compare the number of times Kirk yells at her for not being good at her job compared to any of the other crewmen, he is always giving her a hard time. And, like, very often she's, described as being kind of naive and not really understanding what's going on. Like, in the episode, Trouble with Tribbles, I think it is. The Tribble episode. Mm-hmm. They have Uhura in the position of, like, being offered this fuzzy thing by the merchant, and she has no idea what it is, and she's acting all odd and kind of confused by it. And the other characters are like, "Huh, what's this?" and trying to figure out what it is, and Uhura is just completely taken in by it. And granted, the rest of the crew is eventually, but...
Well, I remember Chekhov standing right there next to her, like, also kind of ogling the thing.
Yeah, but not to the same level that she was. And granted, that's not a super bad example. But, like, if you want a really bad example, there's Space Seed, where, like, every, like, 30 seconds, like, someone has to smack a woman. Like, Space Seed has so much anti-woman violence in it. And, like, granted, these are rather bad guys. So,
It was Khan, and he was just on a power trip.
Right.
But, oh, man, I'm in the future. I can do whatever I want. There's a starship. I'm going to take the starship. I'm going to use this woman to get it.
Yep. And then there was the thing of her, like, of him, like, seducing one of the female crew members to help him. And then Kirk having to, like, almost counter-seduce her, which was very strange.
I don't recall a lot of seduction from Kirk taking place. In fact, as I recall, he was just mad and angry at the crewman. What was her name?
I don't remember her name, but I know that... I do remember a scene where he basically has to use his, like, force of personality. He doesn't actually seduce her, but he has to use his force of personality to convince her that she was wrong, and that she needs to help him again to take back the ship.
I really remember a lot of her lines at kind of near the end of the episode when things were getting resolved and whatnot. I was more or less, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry I did this thing. It wasn't really helping anything, though.
No, I mean, I don't remember exactly what happens, but I do remember that she does actually, basically turn around and help them capture Khan, like, somehow.
Somehow.
I don't remember exactly how it works. I don't have an encyclopedic memory of all Star Trek episodes ever.
Well, this is what I count on you for, though.
You know, I'm sorry, okay? I have failed you. I will commit ritual suicide later.
But all right, now that's fair enough.
We have to finish this podcast. So, guys, if I'm not around next week, you know what happened.
Flying solo, that's right. Okay.
And Uhura is also the character that they are constantly having to explain things to. Whenever we have, whenever there's a question that needs to be asked, like, whenever there's, like, something weird that's happening that the characters need to explain so the audience will understand it, they always have Uhura ask. Like, because for some reason Uhura is just not, is just not very knowledgeable about space and the things in it. And, like, neither is Chekhov, granted. And Chekhov kind of fills that role when Uhura's not around.
Mm-hmm.
Chekhov is at least has the excuse of being the youngest, member of the crew. Or at least the youngest main character.
Right. I do want to give a quick shout-out, actually, to mm-hmm. some guys that are in the IRC here.
Yep.
17 of 85, and Rico. Hi, guys!
Hello.
Waving you guys, if you can see it at all over the internet radios.
I don't think they can do that.
Well, you know, I mean, why are you spoiling my creative process like that?
You know, I have no choice.
You have no choice? Okay, well, I'm done talking about TOS. I will actually move on to Next Generation.
That sounds fair. I mean, TOS does get some slack for being in the 60s. But then we get to Next Generation. And Next Generation really should have known better. They should have taken a lesson from the original series. And to an extent they did, but their opening is not promising because we have Deanna Troi. And Deanna Troi, played by Marina Sirtis. And Marina Sirtis is a very talented actress, and there are a few episodes where she really gets to show it.
I honestly haven't seen her in anything else.
There's a couple of episodes, and I don't remember the name of this one, but the one where she, Data, O'Brien, and who's the fourth one? It's just three of them. She, Data, and O'Brien get possessed by aliens.
Oh, Power Play.
Yeah, Power Play.
I really like that episode.
And she is, instead of playing Troi now, she's playing this ruthless, power-hungry alien, and she does a really good job.
Uh-huh.
And you can see in that episode that she is a very talented actress. You can also see in The Face of the Enemy, which is actually a very good Deanna Troi episode, where she gets kidnapped and surgically altered to look like a Romulan.
Mm-hmm. That's where she's actually having to project herself as this Romulan Tal Shiar commander actually has some sort of authority and dominion over these other guys.
Yeah, she has to exert
Romulans.
She's playing a bluff. Like her entire thing is using her force of personality to get the other Romulans to do what she wants.
Uh-huh.
And she does really good in that episode, and they don't come out and say it, but I got the distinct impression she was actually using her empathic powers to read what the other Romulans were feeling and respond in kind. And, like, you know...
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, given that she's pretty much, at the time, surrounded by the Federation's enemies.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's what she was doing, and that was a really good episode, and I wish they had more like that. But most of the time, and this is kind of a common joke among Trek fans, is that Deanna Troi either states the blatantly obvious, or she can provide no help. Like, if you track, especially the first season, but more so than that, like, even going into the later seasons, if you track the number of times Troi says, I don't know, or I'm not sure, or some kind of line to that equivalent, it is an incredibly high percentage of her dialogue, is the captain asking her a question and her saying, I just don't know, captain. And it feels kind of sad that is her role on the ship, is to say, I don't know, over and over again. And then... To make matters worse, she's just not very good at her job. Like, she's the ship's counselor, but she doesn't really... There are very few episodes where she ever successfully counsels anyone. Most of the time when the crew need counseling, they go to Guinan, which I actually feel like was kind of an out-of-story reasoning behind it, was that the writers realized they were going to have Whoopi Goldberg.
Well, on screen we saw that anyway.
Yeah, we did.
I'm pretty sure off-screen that a lot of the other crewmen and whatnot, they're like in the lower decks and such, probably went to Counselor Troi.
Yeah, and you can definitely say that probably happened off screen.
I mean, she must have some degree of success, I would imagine, because she graduated from psychology school on, was it Earth? Did she go to Earth or was it on Beta Zed?
I think it was on Beta Zed.
On Beta Zed. I mean, she has like a degree in psychology. I'm pretty sure if I remember that being mentioned at all. You know, so there's some, and she's the lieutenant commander at the start of the series, and is a commander at the end of the series, which, you know, has also some merit to it.
Although, why, that's another thing, is that, like, why is she a lieutenant commander? Like, they establish that she is a lieutenant commander, and that there's the episode where she has to actually take control because the Enterprise has struck, like, a quantum filament, and it's completely messed up the ship, and, like, the people who are on, of the people who are on the bridge, she's, like, the only remaining officer. And that is just a clear example.
It was ranking officer, yeah, is what it was. Because originally it was a lieutenant, like no-name lieutenant, mm-hmm, that was... Or, well, yeah. No, she did have a name.
No, she had a name. I just don't remember what it was. She was a guest star.
I was not memorable.
And she died. Like, she died when the Enterprise hit whatever the disaster was.
She was the only command officer available at the time. And then she died and then became whoever's the most ranking officer.
Mm-hmm.
Thank the Lord it wasn't Ro that took command there.
Yeah.
She was the one with a red shirt on the...
She was.
Not red shirt like TOS red shirt, but red command shirt.
Yeah, but I like Ro. I think that would have been cool. But anyway, the thing about that episode is that Troy does have to take command, but it's...
Oh, really? Hang on.
What?
Borg of One. What movies has she been in? Please tell me in the IRC. I beg for your answer.
People are telling us things in the IRC about Marina Sirtis, and we would like to know.
I would like to know, actually. Because I agree she's a good actress. I would love to know what movies she's been in, even if they're... Like sci-fi B movies.
Look, I watched Mammoth because Summer Glau was in it. Okay, I have a unique devotion to actors and actresses. Well, he's not saying anything at the moment, but hopefully he will at some point.
Borg of One, why you no respond?
Anyway,
you make me sad, Borg of One.
If he does, we'll mention it.
It's true.
But in that episode, Troy has to take command, but she is clearly not ready to take command. Whereas either Ro or O'Brien could have done it. But because Troy was the ranking officer, she had to be in command, and she had to, like... And they played it well for what they had,
mm-hmm,
but just practically speaking, it was clear that Troy was not ready for that command position.
Gotcha.
But I think we're coming up on about time for some music.
I would love to listen a little bit of music. I do feel that way, because I do love my beats and my jams.
All right, you lay down some of those.
I will lay down a few of those. Here's a little bit of Voodoo People Remix.
Jay Timbus from Rise of Radio. Join me every Monday and Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, for the show where six string is king. Are you ready to get guitar-ed?
God bless the USA.
Indeed.
I love this country. I do love living in it anyway. So, anyway, back to the end of Troy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you wanted to talk about the episode where she takes the command test.
I did want to talk about the episode where she takes command test. As actually was pointed out in the IRC by Tyree, she wasn't like a command-level officer anyway to begin with. She was on a medical counseling career.
But she is on the bridge, which is a situation where you may need to take command very easily. And that just highlighted why she should not have had that rank. Because suddenly she was put in a position where she had to command much more experienced personnel. And granted, O'Brien's not an officer, but O'Brien was clearly much more qualified to command in that position than she was.
So perhaps O'Brien made him the mistake then of...
No, O'Brien was following protocol because she's the ranking officer. But she should not have had that rank, or she should not have been stationed on the bridge.
Starfleet regs are stupid.
Yeah, basically. Starfleet's officer structure doesn't make any sense. I mean, technically, you know, Beverly Crusher is also a fairly high-ranking officer, but you notice that she stays in sickbay. She isn't stationed on the bridge.
She does actually take watches, though, sometimes.
She does, but, you know
she actually had to take command of the Enterprise during Descent.
She did.
End of Season 6, start of Season 7.
Which is a weird episode, and that doesn't really make sense, but I mean, we can talk about that when we get to Crusher.
Right. But who do we actually got next in the doctor? We got Pulaski.
Yeah, next we're going to talk about Dr. Pulaski.
I really dislike Pulaski for a number of reasons.
All right, well, you go for it. You say something about Pulaski.
Her attitude sucks.
It does.
It's just so terrible. It doesn't mesh up with the rest of the crew whatsoever.
Well, see, they were trying to... With Pulaski, they wanted to go for, like, to reestablish the McCoy-Spock, relationship between Pulaski and Data. But the problem is that, you know, McCoy gives Spock a hard time, and then Spock gives McCoy a hard time. And, you know, they're clearly friends, even though they sometimes are, you know, a little antagonistic towards each other. Whereas Pulaski's entire character was that she hated Data for no reason. And Data, because Data doesn't have an ego, just sat there and took it. Data never retaliated.
Just like kicking a little puppy.
Yeah, and it was just, because Data was one of the fans' favorite characters, too, it was just like, why? It just made her look like a huge bigot. And we never found out why she disliked Data so much. Like, we never found anything in her backstory or even on her outlook on life.
I really think it's just prejudice against machines.
I guess. It just seemed like she was so active in her animosity towards Data. And the thing about Pulaski is that
it's true, we did need the redhead back, Borg. I've heard a lot of different stories as to why Crusher was replaced for season two by Pulaski. Mm-hmm. One was because she was pregnant. You know, she had to, you know, had maternity leave or some such. Another one was that she was being written off the show, and then Patrick Stewart had to, like, ask her back.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard, like, a couple of different things. Story, I don't know if any of them are true or not.
The story that I heard was that she was, like, is that she had, differences with the lead writer at the time, like, Maurice, that was his name. There's a guy named Maurice, who was the lead writer for season one and two, and then he got fired, so they asked her back. But I don't know if I believe that, because if you look at...
she disagreed with the writer?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I believe that that's the reason, because they always say that they didn't know she was coming back. But if you look at Pulaski during season two, she has almost nothing. Like, she is a background character. They never give her any kind of development, which makes me think that she was always intended to be a placeholder, and that she was just there holding Crusher's spot until Crusher could come back. Even though that's not the official story, just looking at the constructions of the episodes, that makes me think that.
And Diana Mulder?
Diana Mulder, I think, is how you say her name.
Uh-huh. She was actually listed as a special guest star the entire time for season two, right?
No, she was listed as main cast.
Really?
Yeah. She was listed as main cast, and what was more puzzling was that she just didn't get... She had one episode, and that, again, in that episode, we still didn't learn much about her.
Mm-hmm.
Really, her only two cool moments in the entire second season are, one, in Up the Long Ladder, where she takes a special antidote so she can drink Worf's Klingon gratitude tea.
Which was tea poisonous to everyone else but Klingons.
Yeah, see, I really liked that, because it was like, you know, she was going the extra mile to participate in his culture and show her appreciation for his culture, and I thought that was cool, although it completely clashes with her status as this bigot who hates Data for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other cool moment of hers was in the Icarus Factor, where she turned out to be an old flame of Riker's dad. And she helped Riker, like, get some insight into his father, and she had some actual good dialogue where she and Riker had, you know, had a talk, and we learned something about, not about her, but about Riker and his father. And she was used as a character development tool there. And, you know, and that was good. Those are the only two cool moments for Dr. Pulaski. The rest of the time, she's just there being unlikable and hates Data. That's really all we know about her.
Pulaski's making me depressed. I don't want to talk about Pulaski anymore.
Pulaski is depressing.
I'm being sad.
I do want to make one comment about Pulaski, is that I do get a little annoyed when people give her a lot of flack for the way she looks and the way her voice sounds. I don't understand that. Like, she has kind of a deep voice, but whatever. I mean, I would think we would be past that point where we would get mad at a woman for having a deep voice. And then, like, her looks, okay, she's not a supermodel, whatever. She's an old doctor. Like,
right.
Are we so...
She looks like a person.
Are we so shallow that we think all women on television have to look like supermodels? I would like to think we could move past that. But, anyway.
Tasha Yar?
Yeah, let's move on from Dr. Pulaski to another strange little character in Next Generation. That is Tasha Yar, played by Denise Crosby, who most people remember as the one who got killed by the Goo Monster.
The Goo Monster.
The Goo Monster.
It was Armus, right?
I don't remember what his name was. I just know it killed Tasha Yar.
RC, let me know what his name is.
That episode is so weird. She dies basically like a red shirt. Like, her death doesn't even accomplish anything. Which they actually make a point of later in yesterday's Enterprise. And a lot of people sort of associate Yar with everything that was wrong with the first season of Next Generation.
Now, this I want to hear.
Well, because
I don't think this is all Tasha's fault.
No, I don't think so either. Tasha Yar, in the first season, was very emotional and always overacted everything. But if you look at the first season, Riker is the most blandest. Picard is a grumpy old man. And Worf who hates children. Those are his two defining character traits. And Worf is just an idiot. So I don't really think that that's Tasha Yar's fault. And I think that if she had stayed with the show, we would have seen her develop into along more interesting lines. And she does that. If you see her she guest stars in Yesterday's Enterprise.
Right.
And again, in All Good Things, where she's actually a much more well-rounded character, and we actually get to see...
As Tasha Yar.
Yeah, as Tasha Yar. Where we get to see her what she would be like when she's not suffering from first season writing.
Right.
And to be honest, I'm actually amazed that Denise Crosby was the only Next Generation cast member who decided she didn't want to stay with the show.
She had said she didn't appreciate the direction, or she wasn't getting enough stage time.
I think it was that she didn't appreciate the direction. I don't know that for a fact. But I mean, looking at the role she has to play, I think it's almost not the second episode, but it's one of the early episodes where she
Borg Worf was a wimp.
Yeah, he was. In the episode where she gets captured by the strife-filled planet populated entirely by black people, because that wasn't racist. That entire episode, they have this little moment where Picard and Troy have this weird dig at her for having for having gotten feelings for her kidnapper, and it's like such a weird random moment.
How dare you have Stockholm syndrome?
Yeah, I did not understand it. But I do feel sad that she wasn't in the show later. I feel like maybe she and Worf could have had an interesting relationship, and that would have actually given Worf some development that I feel he never really gets, even in the later seasons.
Well, they already had kind of a bit of a relationship, I recall. It was only mentioned a couple of times, when they were off to do, a Parisi Square tournament or some mm-hmm. such, where he'd bet, a bunch of, I guess, quote-unquote, money on her. It wasn't really clear, but the ship's pool, he was involved
what
in the
he was,
pool.
Yeah, what he was betting, we're not sure.
Replicator rations on
my
the
bet
Enterprise.
Was communicators. I bet everyone had to put their communicator, and if you lost, you just had to go without a communicator until they issued you another one.
That's like the dunce cap on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
You don't get a communicator.
But they could have that could have been interesting.
Uh-huh.
And they could have done some cool stuff with that.
Right.
But really, that's about all you can say about Tasha Yar. Although Denise Crosby is in a really rad episode of Dexter. So if anyone has watched Dexter, she is Dexter's first victim. And she's really cool there, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's about all we can say about Tasha Yar. And I think I want to move on to who, to me, is the most interesting TNG character. And that is Beverly Crusher.
I think she's the most motherly character.
She definitely is. And not just because she has a son on the show. And it's, Wesley is not exactly... a good character, as most people who watch TNG will agree.
I think he'll be in the Tom Paris episode.
Yeah, probably. But Crusher herself is... she's definitely the best female character that Next Generation has, or at least the best main cast member,
mm-hmm.
Because she is competent in her job, and she's more or less likable.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't have a really abrasive personality, and she can do her job well. Although, interestingly enough, she has very few... medical episodes. There are not a lot of episodes with Crusher where she's actually solving some kind of medical problem as part of the drama.
At least not a complicated one.
Yeah, usually with Crusher, she either can solve the problem or she can't. There really aren't a lot of episodes where the drama hinges on can she solve the problem. And in fact, two of her best episodes are Suspicions and Remember Me. And Suspicions is the episode where she's investigating the Ferengi scientist and his star shield, where he can fly into stars with a shuttlecraft.
Oh, yeah!
And then Remember Me is this episode where she's wandering around the Enterprise and everyone is disappearing. And both of those are mystery episodes. And I find that really funny that the ship's physician, her best two episodes are mystery episodes. Maybe not her best, but two of her best episodes.
Mm-hmm. I thought Sub Rosa was a good one.
Sub Rosa, that was the one where she found out that her ancestors were being seduced by a Scottish alien, right?
Well, it wasn't a Scottish alien. He just took Scottish form.
Yeah, Scottish
form,
accent.
Well, no, he was human form. He was incorporeal is what he was, and he hid in like a candle.
Right.
That was his, what do you call it? Like magic foci or something
like
that?
Yeah, it was his phylactery. Let's just go with that.
Yeah, that thing.
He kind of reminded me of some depictions I've seen of Lord Byron. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Who's Lord Byron?
Lord Byron is a famous English Scottish poet. He's a romantic poet. We're not going to go into Lord Byron right now.
Serving right for being uncultured.
But he was, that episode, I haven't seen it for a while, but I remember not terribly caring for it.
I think it was the closest thing they got to a Halloween episode.
No, there was the one where they got into the ship and everyone was turning into animals. Which one was that?
That was Genesis in season 7.
Genesis, where they were, where Worf was a horrible monster. I think that was their Halloween episode. It was full of dark hallways.
That's true.
Whereas,
I think it's really good. I thought Sub Rosa was really good because it actually showed Crusher in an actually emotional. What am I trying to say?
What are you trying to say, Bob?
I thought it showed kind of more of the emotional side of her, because like the other two episodes that we mentioned were more mystery driven, and that was her using her wits to be able to get out of these situations, whatever they are. Mm-hmm. Even though, in fact, I think Remember Me was actually more her just kind of wandering around a ship and going, "Oh my gosh, everyone's disappearing. What's going on?"
You know, she has to solve the mystery. She eventually figures it out. What about how she's trapped in a warp bubble?
Well, yeah, she does, but...
She figures it out. She asks the computer a lot of questions in that episode.
It's true.
It made me wonder how the if the computer was actually that interactive, or if that was just her mind. But if you want to talk about an episode where Crusher gets to be more emotional, I think The High Ground, the one where she gets captured by terrorists and, like, figures out that they actually have, like, a real cause, but they're not good guys, but, like, she understands why they're fighting. Mm-hmm. Now, that episode was groundbreaking, in my opinion. Because, you know, it showed another side to, you know, people who we normally just tend to assume are always the bad guys. Like, really, how many instances of, you know, people who are terrorists do you know where they're portrayed in an even slightly positive light?
Or, quote-unquote, freedom fighters.
Or freedom fighters.
I wasn't very satisfied with that episode, actually.
Really? You weren't?
Yeah, I thought it did a good job of actually depicting both sides of, you know, what they perceive just terrorist, you know, like, campaign. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really have a good, like, ending message or anything like that, like most episodes do.
See, I felt that the ending message was quite good, which was that there's no magic.
Please tell me what it was.
Okay, so the ending of this episode was that there is the ending message of The High Ground, in my opinion, was that there is no, like, magic fix for this kind of problem. And at the end of the episode, you know, it ends with one kid not firing his weapon when he has the chance, and it's like, you know, that's like the closest they get to solving the problem. And it's a clear example of this problem cannot be solved by traditional, like, you go in, fix the problem, and then leave. Which is, you know, kind of what the Next Generation crew was really good at.
Mm-hmm. So how does Crusher fit in this whole puzzle?
Crusher fits in this puzzle, and again, this is kind of Crusher playing second fiddle to the terrorist leader himself. But this is, Crusher shows us, like, you know, we get to see Crusher and learn about her compassion for, you know, for people who are hurt, because, again, they capture her because a lot of their people are dying from this device that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a clear example of, like, you know, Crusher learning and sympathizing with their cause, but then still remembering that they are incredibly ruthless and that they will kill innocent people to accomplish their mission. And, you know, it has some interesting interplay between her and the terrorist leader. I was actually kind of sad when Picard also gets captured, because that's basically the end of their relationship. Because at that point, Picard kind of takes over. And that made me a little sad.
I'm not sure if I agree with second fiddle necessarily. I think he provides a good... maybe I guess second fiddle would be a good way to describe it. She does provide a good balance for Picard, because she says, mm-hmm. Oh man, like, we should help these people with, like, the medical supplies and such, and, you know, mm-hmm. like, they're gonna kill you if you don't cooperate, and Picard has to, like, make mention, like, you know, we're Starfleet officers, and we, like, need to escape.
Yeah, we need to not get involved in this.
That's, like, a good motivation to leave if they want to kill us.
Yeah. But that's actually a problem. That is Crusher's main problem, is that she just doesn't get a lot of development. She gets a couple of good episodes, but really, that's about it. She does not get, most of the episodes she does appear in, she's playing second fiddle to someone else. Mm-hmm. Like, Picard is the most common one. And those episodes are really more about Picard than they are about her.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the biggest problem with Crusher. I also really, in the early seasons, Crusher was really, really preachy. And that kind of annoyed me. And I know people say the same thing about Picard, but for some reason, Crusher's preaching annoyed me more than Picard's did.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and that was the biggest problem that I had with her, was that she just didn't get enough development as a character.
And you still think she cuts mustard, though, right?
Yeah, she does cut mustard. She does cut mustard. She is definitely the best female character on the show, and she's a passable female character. I'm just sad that she wasn't nearly as good as Data or Picard, who mm-hmm. are, like, the two big heavy hitters of Next Generation when it comes to character development.
Right. Well, that wraps up the TNG segment, and we have DS9 coming up, but we've got something really awesome that Orin wants to give you guys to listen to. What
I
is
do.
That?
This is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, this is episode 1 of Tales from the DMZ. This episode is titled A Choice of Targets. It is a radio play about a Maquis raider. For those of you who know about anything about DS9, the Maquis were established as a group of Federation citizens who banded together to resist the Cardassian presence in their colonies. They are either freedom fighters or terrorists, depending on what side of the fight you happen to be on. In this episode, we feature voice acting talents from Michelle Heiner as Save, Jonathan Preshaw as Andars, Brianna Stavlesky as Maria.
Which she actually has her, going to be getting her own show here, actually, yep. coming up on Trek Radio.
Yeah, she's going to have her own.
Rise of Radio.
She's going to have her own Saturday morning show. We also have Ari Ashkenazi as Tarek. And finally, we have Graham Swanson as a guest starring role, and he does a great job. So, Bob, make it happen.
All right, we're going to make this happen here. What's this episode called?
This episode is called A Choice of Targets.
Choice of Targets.
Why doesn't somebody else go?
I'll go last.
You always try to go last, Tarek, and then you never go. Come on, strangest thing you've ever eaten.
Well, I had gach once.
Come on, gach isn't weird, it's exotic. I had gach for breakfast before we left.
Oh, give him a break, Anders. What have you got?
You asked for it. It was about a year ago on Bajor. The Cardassians hadn't been gone 2 days, but they wrecked everything when they left. So Starfleet sends us down some supply crates from DS9. I open one, and it's full of these rotten, slimy beans.
And you ate them?
It was the beans or my boots. I swear they nearly made me faint.
Wait, the weirdest thing you've ever eaten is natto? I love natto.
You're crazy.
At least I'm not squeamish.
Fine, what's yours? I bet it can't touch natto.
Cardassian voles.
No way!
Yep, that's all there was when supplies ran out on Brima. Fried them up and ate them with pepper.
What about you, Captain?
She's not our captain.
I just meant...
The McKee don't have captains or commanders or admirals. Her name is Savay.
Sorry.
You are correct, Maria, but there is no need to become agitated. Tarek misspoke.
Whatever. He should have known better.
Hey, no big deal. Come on, Savay. It's your turn.
Are you certain? I do not wish to upset your digestion before the mission.
Ooh, Savay's got something she thinks we can't handle. Come on, give us your best shot.
As you wish. At the Kitomer Peace Conference, during a celebration in honor of Chancellor Azatbur, I consumed the still-beating heart of a Targ.
I think I'm going to be sick.
You actually ate it?
It was a great honor to be included. Refusing would have been illogical.
The whole thing?
None of the other officers present elected to participate, and custom clearly called for the entire heart to be consumed.
Yeah, I'm gonna be sick.
I hope he's done before we reach the depot.
He'll be fine.
That'll be Gulpadar's latest broadcast. I wonder what the bastard's got to say today.
It is with a heavy heart that I inform you of the latest tragedy to befall Cardassia's colonies in the Demilitarized Zone. 2 days ago, Maquis terrorists destroyed a power station on the Calordis colony, killing 15 Cardassian civilians and leaving thousands more without power. Rest assured that we are tracking down those responsible, and they will be brought to justice.
Hey, I wanted to see if he'd mention me.
We are approaching the Ular colony. Tarek, to the engine room.
Yeah, I'm going.
Maria, charge weapons and raise shields. Navar, scan for Cardassian ships.
Shields up, phasers and torpedoes ready.
Nothing on sensors yet.
Kumari, Einar, this is Apache. Follow us on thrusters only. Engage impulse engines on my mark.
Here comes the atmosphere.
Mark.
Ground defenses still haven't locked onto us.
I have depot in range.
Fire.
Their shields absorb most of that. The depot is still standing.
I'm bringing us around for another pass. Kumari, Einar, stay with us.
Spoonheads are finally awake. Colony defenses are locking onto us.
Firing.
Good shooting. Nothing left but rubble.
Kumari, Einar, break and withdraw.
Spoonheads are firing.
Losing shields.
Tarek, engine status.
Working. Barely.
We're clear of the atmosphere.
I'm engaging warp engines. Status.
No sign of pursuit. We're clear. The Aenor didn't make it. Spoonheads caught them on the way out.
Tarek. Tarek, we need you out here.
What is it?
Come on.
I really should be working on the engines.
You're new. When the Maquis lose one of our own, this is what we do. Anders, do you have the Romulan ale?
I've got something that's blue and alcoholic.
That'll do. There's glasses under the console. Pour. To the Einar and her crew, Tammy, Bendis, Orkar, they gave their lives for their home, for their families, for all of us. They will never be forgotten. The weapons in that depot will never hurt anyone thanks to them. Down the hatch.
I think you got some coolant by mistake.
You might be right.
What's the status of the engines?
Falling apart. You need to get back there if you want to stay at warp.
Maria, help him. Anders, keep scanning for Cardassian ships. We're still an hour from the Badlands.
Actually, I think...
Oh, come on. Ugh, this place is a mess.
Half of these systems need to be replaced, so I've had to improvise a little.
That one's flashing red.
No. Help me turn this.
See, that wasn't so hard. What else can I do?
Here, replace those burnout isolinear chips with these. I need to seal this conduit.
Okay. Some of them don't fit.
Just push harder. They'll fit.
Hard to believe this is what we fight the Cardassians in.
Look, that's not my fault. I tell them we need new parts, they give me junk. I say we need 6 people to run the ship effectively, they give us 4.
Look on the bright side. This way, Savay and I don't have to share a cabin.
I'm not kidding. Another mission like that without a refit, we won't need the Cardassians' help. We'll blow ourselves up.
You got another red light.
What? Where? Arr, damn it!
What about the red light?
Ignore it. It's just a broken indicator.
Okay, let me get the med kit. Here it is. Now hold still. The dermal regenerator is on its last legs. Alright, back to work then.
Why bother? I'm fighting a losing battle here.
Hey, you're an engineer. You do magic with machines all the time.
I'm not an engineer. You need to go to school to be an engineer.
Just fix the engine.
We are now holding steady at 1-5.
There's still nothing out there. I think we can declare this mission a success.
Perhaps.
Are you kidding? One raider for an entire depot? With those odds, we could take the whole Cardassian Empire.
Where were their ships? It was illogical to leave such a valuable installation undefended.
You think they were off on their own mission?
Possibly. Put me on a priority channel to the committee.
Done.
Committee, this is Savay of the Apache. The Ular Weapons Depot has been destroyed. However, we detected no defense ships in the area. I believe they may be planning an attack somewhere in the demilitarized zone. Please advise.
And sent.
How long until they receive it?
With this equipment? I'd say 20 minutes.
Very good.
So why are you here?
Excuse me?
I'd expect someone with all your Starfleet experience to be on the committee yourself. But here you are, in the trenches.
Indeed.
Not going to give me anything here?
What of yourself? A Bajoran intelligence officer should have merited a committee position as well.
Ha! I asked for this assignment. Give me field work over piloting a desk any day. In fact, hold on. There's a ship coming into sensor range.
Is it from the Ular colony?
No, it's going the wrong direction for that. Doesn't look like they've seen us.
Maria, we need you at weapons. Tarek, shut down everything except sensors and life support.
Got it.
What's going on?
Another ship approaching at warp 4. Looks like a Cardassian freighter.
Escorts?
None.
Scan again. This area is far outside established shipping lanes.
Maybe they're hoping to avoid someone like us.
Still nothing. They're all alone.
Armament?
One class 2 phaser array. Nothing to worry about. They've seen us. I'm jamming their transmissions.
Tarek, full power now.
I'm working on it.
Lane in a pursuit course. Maria, lock weapons and fire on my command.
We're closing on them.
I have an easy shot at their engines.
Andar, scan their hold.
What? Why?
I wish to know what they are carrying.
What does it matter?
Scan the hold.
Looks like mainly organic material.
Most likely food or medical supplies, then?
Probably.
Power down weapons, Maria. We are breaking off.
No, that's crazy. What does it matter what they're carrying? That ship is a perfect target.
Our orders are to stop Cardassian ships only if we believe they are carrying weapons.
To hell with orders. Who do you think those supplies are for? Cardassian soldiers.
Your opinion is noted.
You're a fool. Do you think the Cardassians would hesitate for a second in your place?
I cannot say.
That's because you don't know them like I do. Maria, tell her.
He's probably right, Savay.
The DMZ is not Bajor.
Prophets, damn you!
We should reach the Badlands in approximately 15 minutes.
We should have destroyed that freighter.
You could have fired without my orders.
What was that about? Anders just about knocked me over.
We had a disagreement. How are the engines?
They'll hold together.
Take the sensors, then.
Got it.
What was that?
I think we're being hailed. Yeah, it's a coded transmission from the committee. Cardassian shuttles are attacking Nigel Station. We've been ordered to intercept.
Lane in a new course. Tarek, we will need all possible speed from the engines.
I'll see what I can do.
Maria, get Andars out here. We need him at sensors.
Got it.
Computer, note the following in the log. Our first mission has been successfully concluded. Ship and crew have functioned well. End and save.
Man, I do love me that StarCraft intro right there.
Yeah, that StarCraft intro is the raddest.
It is so rad. Welcome back, folks. We're here on All Things Trek here on RiseRadio.com. If you'd like to join us and chat with us live, we're in the IRC. That can be found through the website, through the community tab. Just go there, click in community, go to the IRC chat room. You can join us there. We got a couple of people in there, actually. We got Unkeel, Borg of One, I'm in there, Tosk is in there. You know, and everyone wants to be like Tosk.
It's basically a party in there.
It is like a party in there. And we'd love to invite you to our party. I do enjoy the party. So, I hear there's a contest going on right now.
I have heard about that.
For Las Vegas.
Tell me more.
Right now. So, we have going on right now, if you donate to RiserRadio.com, you will be entered in a chance to win airline tickets to fly to Las Vegas for the Star Trek convention that's taking place there. And who will you meet, you ask? Who might you meet? Well, obviously, besides the Star Trek cast people.
Who will we meet?
We're going to meet, or you're going to meet, rather, Xander, Tosk, and Roxy. And they're going to take you out to dinner. And, you know, I hear that they eat pretty well.
I heard that they do, and it'll be on them.
It will be on them. You know, I wish I could go. But unfortunately, I'm busy. So you won't see me down there, or you won't see Warren and I down there either. You know, but, you know, we just maybe have more important things to do.
Maybe.
You know, than being hanging out in Las Vegas. You know. I wish I could go. All right, so that was Tales from the DMZ.
It was.
Our first episode.
And we are in the midst of making a second one, although that will take a little bit, as the sound editing is kind of time intensive. But eventually, you will have a second episode and a third episode after that. So we hope
you fourth or fifth, you say maybe?
Oh, definitely. This is going to go for a while. So we're glad you enjoyed it. And next, we are going to move on to talking about the ladies of DS9,
Deep Space Nine,
which is my favorite Star Trek series, and incidentally has my two favorite ladies on it.
Who are your two favorite ladies?
Well, my first is Major Kira Nerys, later Colonel.
Major Kira Nerys, later Colonel Kira Nerys.
Interestingly enough, Starfleet has only had one Colonel, and that was in Star Trek VI, and he turned out to be a traitor. So after that, they've never used the rank Colonel. So she's from the Bajoran Militia.
Just because of that guy?
I don't know if it was just because of that guy. I'm not sure why. But he was the only Colonel you ever see in Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
But Kira Nerys, played by Nana Visitor. Was
Is that how you say that?
Nana Visitor, I believe. I think it's Nana. I don't think it's Nana. But Nana Visitor. She was originally actually supposed to be Ro Laren, played by Michelle Forbes from The Next Generation. But then Michelle Forbes decided she wasn't interested in the part. So they switched it over to Kira. And that's why originally Kira and Ro are kind of similar. They're both kind of combative, kind of antagonistic Bajoran women.
I always thought Kira was kind of butch.
I mean, she is. But they're not exactly the same, but they are similar. And they diverge more as the show goes on. And actually, as much as I like Ro, and I do really like Ro, I think that it was a good thing that they went with Kira instead. Because Ro wasn't actually from Bajor. She actually grew up in a refugee camp off of Bajor. So if she had been in the show instead of Kira, we wouldn't have had a native Bajoran on the main cast. And so we wouldn't have been able to represent Bajor's issues through her. Because
right.
even though she is Bajoran, Ro still would have been an outsider. And Kira is just an amazing character all around.
Excellent female character all around.
Excellent character in general. She's one of my favorite characters on the main cast of DS9. And she just accomplishes so many things that the other female characters of Star Trek are never able to. She's a strong woman character. Like obviously, she will mess you up. And she starts,
it's true. If I got in a fist fight with Kira, I'd probably lose.
Yeah, you do not want to do that. And she's also she starts off in opposition to Sisko. She and Sisko are at odds for the first season or so. And it works out really well, and they have a really interesting dynamic that way. But at the same time, Kira doesn't fall into the trap that a lot of writers fall into when they're writing strong women characters. Let me put some air quotes around that. Which is that they are strong.
That's okay. It's a creative process.
Which they are strong women in that they have no emotions, and that they don't, like, connect with other human beings. And Kira doesn't do that. Kira has her own relationships. In fact, Kira's romantic relationships are a really interesting part of the show, especially her relationship with Fedic Barile. And later with Odo. I wasn't a big fan of her relationship with Shakar, but I just didn't like Shakar as a side character. But her relationships are
really
very...
I thought that was a good one.
Well, it was good when it first showed when Shakar first showed up. He was this cool, like, kind of ex resistance fighter mentor figure.
Yeah, she admired him.
Yeah, but then, like, the second time he showed up, he actually looked shorter. I don't know what was up with that, but he looked like he had shrunk, and he was suddenly really petty, and he and O'Brien kept getting into these, like, little tiffs about Kira's techno pregnancy.
Oh yeah, that was with Keiko O'Brien.
Yeah, with,
right?
with Keiko's baby.
That Julie Bashir concocted up. Oh, if we take the baby, put it over in this other womb, it'll be okay.
Well, because they needed an excuse because Nana Visitor was pregnant, and so they couldn't hide it forever. But Kira has a very complete and interesting character arc where she starts off as being almost xenophobic. In her hatred of Cardassians and her distrust of the Federation, and then she moves forward. She has a couple of great episodes with Cardassians. The first one is Duet, which is the best episode of the first season, arguably one of the best episodes of DS9 or of Star Trek ever. And she gets to hash out her issues with a Cardassian, and it's really complex. And then by the end of the series, she doesn't like Cardassians magically, but she's kind of gotten over her hatred of all Cardassians. And she's grown and matured, and she has an actual character arc, which is something that most of the other characters especially in TNG, can't say. Most of them don't really grow and mature; they sort of stay the same.
Well, that comes down to, I think, style of shows. We didn't see a lot of overarching stories in TNG so much because those were all kind of individual adventure stories. I mean, there was like some stuff that's connected together, like Data Lore, for instance, where we had Lorca in a couple episodes, and the Borg.
I'm not talking about overarching stories. I'm talking about character arcs. Data has a character arc in The Next Generation. By the end of the show, he is distinctly different than he was at the start, and so does Picard to an extent. I'm not just talking about that he's better written by the end of the show. He has a character arc, and even Troy actually kind of has a character arc. Crusher doesn't really. Crusher is more or less the same. Crusher is Crusher. She doesn't really change that much. Whereas Kira is clearly changed by her experiences, and has great dialogue and is a flawed character. She's not perfect, and her relationship with Gul Dukat especially is really fascinating. And their antagonistic relationship towards each other, and it even has some romantic tension. It's all from Dukat's side. It's not like Kira returns the feelings anyway, but Dukat is clearly infatuated with her. And it's especially funny because they established that on Cardassia, the way that you show that you like someone is by being argumentative and difficult with them, and by being mean to them.
That just the female to male, or is that both ways?
They didn't establish if it was one way or the other, but we know it's at least female to male.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's both ways, because she took, in that episode, the Cardassian woman takes O'Brien's like irritability towards her as a sign of affection.
Okay, so I suppose it is male.
And then she's irritable back at him. So it's kind of, you can look at it from Dukat's perspective is like by the nature of her personality, like Kira is doing all the things that he would normally anticipate as a sign of of affection from a Cardassian woman, and so that's kind of interesting.
That is, I've never realized that.
Yeah, I really thought that was cool when I figured it out. Like, I had an epiphany right there. And then like she has a lot of like inner growth moments, like when she goes back in time with the orb and finds out that her mother was a collaborator, and she kind of has to question. Not even her hatred of Cardassians, but her undying hatred of collaborators. And she has to recognize that some of them had reasons for what they did, and they weren't just universally evil.
I really think that was actually her being more petty.
Really?
Yeah, because it was suddenly someone very close to her, her mother, that was, suddenly deemed as a collaborator in her mind, and she goes, oh, collaborators aren't so bad. I mean, it really had to take for her, something very close to her emotional center in order for her to realize, oh man, collaborators are bad, and those sometimes be forced into these situations. Whereas before, it was like, collaborators are bad. You must kill them all.
Yeah, that's true. But I accepted that as just a consequence of her being very scarred from the occupation, as are most Bajorans. You know, she isn't alone in that trait.
And I think it shows her just be really extreme.
You think so?
Extremist, yeah.
All right. Well, we can agree to
that. I don't think that necessarily she went out and like killed like, you know, Cardassian children in an orphanage or anything like that, or, you know, burn down the daycare center on Bajor, you know, that was full of Cardassian kids. I don't think that kind of extremism, but I think it's very, very evident that, you know, just at least at the start of the show, that, you know, there's this extremism about it.
Oh, that's definitely
true. And I do think that it's one of those turning points for Kira, but it comes across to me in a very, very petty way.
Mm. Yeah, I can see where you're coming from on that. I don't really feel that way, but I get your point.
You know, it's just that, like, not all people are going to be these cardboard cutouts in the way you see them in the conflict that you're involved with. You know, at the time, her being involved in the Shakar terrorist cell,
yeah,
as was deemed by, you know, the Cardassians, or Shakar resistance fighter cell, is what they were calling it, or freedom fighter cell. You know, but I think while it is character growth, and it does get her to see that, you know, it's like, oh, no, Kleber is bad, you know, this is something that they might have been forced into for a variety of reasons. You know, it's just like, you know, really, Kira, I mean, you couldn't have just, like, sat down with a book and read about it?
Maybe. No, it had to be...
Wouldn't have been a very interesting TV, but...
I really liked, especially when Kira is, like, sent over to help the Cardassian resistance against the Dominion.
Yes!
That arc is really fantastic.
I mean, she was all for it, wasn't she?
Well, yeah, I mean, she was. She wanted to help, you know, she wanted to stop the Dominion, but she clearly was having problems, both, like, her own problems, and then the Cardassians she was helping didn't really like her, either.
Well, they didn't like it because... I think the justification they had is because she was wearing a Bajoran uniform.
It's no, they gave her a Starfleet uniform.
Well, they did give her a Starfleet uniform because of the objection that she was Bajoran, was under, you know, Bajoran jurisdiction or whatever it was, right? But it's like, Starfleet was like, okay, well, we need to get her over there. Let's slap a uniform on her with the rank of commander.
Right.
Let's do that.
But even then, like, she had to a number of times restrain herself from laying the smackdown on some obnoxious Cardassian command. And then at one point, I think Damar actually has to, like, I don't remember if he actually shoots one of his subordinates, but he has to, you know, intervene and stop one of his subordinates from starting a fight.
He does, yeah. Yes. And that's when they're trying to steal one of the ships, one of the Geminar ships, because it's got some new weapon on it that the Marine are installing or something.
And, like, that was just a great arc for Kira, and the way she spends... It's kind of interesting that she spends the last... Like, she starts off having just freed her planet from an occupation, and then she ends the series freeing Cardassia from an occupation. So, you know, has some nice synergy there. But I feel like that is... We've said a lot about Kira. I would like to move on to the other really great female character.
Who's that?
That is Jedzia Dax.
Oh, Dax.
You do not like Dax? I'm not sure we can be friends anymore, Bob. I don't know if we can still be friends.
Say what you want to say about Dax first, and then I'll get to some of my complaints.
I really liked Dax for a number of reasons. But, I was a big fan of the symbiont. I thought that they did some really interesting things with that, especially when she started like getting to meet some of her past lives. And it gave her this really great dynamic with Sisko, where she was both... She was Sisko's mentor, but at the same time, Sisko was her mentor. Like, it was simultaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it gave her this really great duality of most of the time she was very calm and collected, but then she could, like she could start channeling Curzon or one of her previous hosts, especially in her interactions with the Klingons, and she could get, like, you know, really passionate and, like, really, and like really full of energy, like, suddenly. And I thought that was really neat. And then, you know, again, I think that, like I said, she is a great foil for Worf and Sisko. She helps Worf a lot with his development when he joins the show.
Absolutely.
Especially with their... And their romance interest is really cool. And I do wish she'd had more of her own episodes. She didn't have that many. She had a few. But even in episodes where she is a side character, I really liked her, and I thought she was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell me why you don't like Dax.
So arrogant.
So arrogant?
So arrogant.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. You see, if you watch the episode, she definitely struts around like she's the one in charge. And the one, some episodes where she does have to herself, where she's like either a centerpiece or it's all about her, it's very much about her being vulnerable, and she's not all that. You know, like, what's a good one? The one where... the psychopath killer lifetime that she had has started to resurface and such. I mean, she tries to, like, you know, in, I guess, the dream sequences or the hallucinations she's having, she's trying to physically fight it and such and trying to, you know, assert that physical aggressiveness that she has about herself, but just ultimately fails. And it comes to a point to where she just can't admit that she's having this problem. And it develops into a huge problem for her, to where all of her coworkers around her, colleagues, go, "You've got a problem. We need to fix this." You know, it's just like her own arrogance just gets in the way so much. And it kills me that she won't, like, go ask for help when she obviously needs to go ask for help.
See, I took a different lesson from that episode. I took that, like, you know, her, like, where she tries to, like, fight in the dream sequences, like, she's fighting herself is the thing. Like she's not fighting Juran. Juran is a part of her. And so, like...
That's the psychopath killer.
Yeah, Juran is the... Yeah. Was her psychopath killer host. And she is, you know, she's fighting against that part of herself because she doesn't like it. But the idea is that you can't just reject part of yourself.
Right.
And I thought that was really cool. And I actually... Maybe I haven't seen the episode for a while, but I don't remember her, like... Like, I remember that she doesn't go for help because, like, for a while she doesn't really realize that she has a problem. Because, like, her symbiont is making her go a little crazy.
Well, it's about the second or third hallucination sequence in the show that she realizes she has a problem, but she doesn't really address it to anybody. It's not until it starts affecting her work and people start actively noticing, oh my gosh, there's something wrong, that her friends get involved.
Yeah, see, I feel like if I was going insane, I might not be, you know, calm and rational about it. You know, I feel like that was my feeling.
But if you felt that you were losing your mind in some capacity, though, and you felt you had a problem, wouldn't you go tell somebody?
Well, rationally, I should, but I don't think I can count on myself to act rationally if I'm going insane.
That's a fair point, I suppose. But, I mean, Dax still looked like she was pretty well in control of her faculties and such.
I mean, I can chalk that up to pride, which, you know, she definitely has a lot of pride. That is the thing about...
Just so prideful and arrogant.
See, I didn't have a problem with that.
It makes me rage so hard.
It didn't bother me. I did not have a problem with her arrogance. I felt usually it was well justified, and I did like how she eventually became command. Like, you know, she became a commander in her own right. She was commanding.
Well, she took the Defiant out a couple times in combat.
Yeah,
missions.
She was for several months. I mean, you know, they're off the station for several months, and for most of that, Sisko is sitting behind a desk, and she's the one actually commanding the Defiant. Even though for some reason she's still wearing a blue uniform, that was kind of weird. But. You know, and I also, like, even though her death, spoilers, she dies, her death didn't feel was well handled.
Yeah, you did that last week about not wanting to do spoilers and whatnot, and here you are, spoiling the end of stuff.
Anyway, Jadzia dies, and her death I do not feel is well handled. She basically dies to show that Takat has superpowers now, which, again, was not the writer's fault. The writers had to kill her because her actress, Terry Farrell, decided she didn't want to be in the show anymore.
No, that's not true.
It's not true?
It's not true. She did want to be a part of it, but Paramount had other plans for her. And it was some, like, clause in her contract, something like that, with Paramount saying that if we want you for something else, we can pull you. And,
really?
Yes.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, because so she got pulled. Because interviews later, she says, I still wanted to do Deep Space Nine, but I couldn't because Paramount wanted me to do something else.
Huh.
So that's why she went in, like, this, like, third-rate sitcom that I, like, saw once. And she does a good job acting, but the sitcom was terrible.
Oh, now I feel...
She was, like, a coffee shop owner or something like that.
Now I feel way worse about this than I did. Oh,
ooh,
thanks.
Please do. Please continue.
Thanks, Bob.
Oh, man.
Thanks. Now you've made me more depressed. I thought she was leaving of her own volition. Now that I know she was, like, kidnapped from DS9. God, I feel like I should do something.
And
about
that's why, that. What was her name?
Ezri?
Yeah, what's the actress's name?
The actress's name is... I have no idea how to pronounce this.
Nicole Dubois?
Nicole Dubois. Or Nicole de Boer.
De Boer.
You were probably saying it right the first time.
It looks French.
But even though, you know, again, back to in-universe, even though I didn't really like her death, the way that the aftermath of her death was cool. The way that Worf especially responded to her dying, and the episode they had... which was about getting her into Stovacor, as it were, by doing, like, a really, really cool mission. Like, that was cool. And that, like, gave... You know, even Quark went on that mission.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really nice. And it was, like, you know, to show that she hadn't just died and then was suddenly forgotten.
Right.
You know, whereas, like, in Next Generation, when Tasha Yar dies, they barely talk about her after that. Whereas, even though Tasha Yar was actually still in the show in a couple of episodes, whereas Jadzia never comes back.
Right.
And so I guess this is a good point to segue into Ezri Dax.
Yeah.
Who they replace.
She's cute.
She is cute, but she looks like a kid. I don't know. I can't... She looks too young to me. She looks like a child.
Well, I think that just reinforced her inexperience. One, dealing with having a symbiote suddenly shoved inside of her.
Right.
Right. So, and then also her experience as a counselor. Because she was an ensign when she just showed up at Sisko's door on Earth.
But I'll have you know that she doesn't start off well, first of all, because she's a violation of canon.
Really?
Yeah, because they establish in the episode Equilibrium, which is the one where we were just talking about, where Jadzia is having flashbacks from her serial killer self, that the Symbiosis Commission maintains the illusion that only like 2% of Trill are viable to become hosts. And it's not something you can just scan them for. Like, it's a long series of tests.
Right.
And if you put the symbiont in anyone else, it will kill them. And then later in the episode, they do establish that's a lie, and it's actually closer to 50%. But even assuming that the doctor who put this... Because the justification is that the symbiont was dying, they needed to put it in the host, like, immediately.
Right.
But
and she was the only one available.
What doctor can you... Find me a doctor who will agree to perform an operation that has a 50% chance of killing one patient to save another. Like, what doctor would do that? That is such a violation of, do no harm. And assuming that he knew that, which I think is a very low chance, because it is a very well-kept secret.
It might have been informed consent. I mean, it's like, this might kill you. There's a 50% chance you will be dead.
Right, but I mean, like...
Because they can take the symbiont out in the first 24 hours, can't they? It's not until, like, 2 days later that's not a problem.
But, like, if rejection starts, I guess, but it just seems like a huge risk to take. And they don't even acknowledge it. And again, I would assume that that doctor probably didn't know that about this cover-up. I would probably assume that it was like a 98% chance of killing her.
Yeah, we'll be fine. All right, so just lie down on the table. We're going to put this worm inside of you. It'll be good.
And of course, then she's also a counselor, which
why wouldn't Ezri know that, though, if that even was the case? Because she's the Trill.
Because the Trill don't know. It's a secret that the Trill keep from the...
Well, right,
from
but her operating knowledge at that point would be that only, like, the 2% or whatever it is can actually take on a symbiont, right?
So you think she would say, wait, no.
This is a bad idea.
Her self-preservation instinct would kick in, and she'd be like, no, you can't put that in me.
I don't want it. Don't take it.
And then, of course, she's also a counselor, which means she's bad at her job, because, you know, welcome to Star Trek.
I love how you have the perception that just counselors are just bad at their jobs.
Well, that's a perception. That's not Star Trek. That's American television. Like, seriously, if you look at counselors and psychologists in American television, they typically aren't very good at their jobs. And I think that that's just a reaction to Americans not liking to be psychoanalyzed. Like, wizened old mentors like Guinan, they can counsel you, they can give you emotional truths, but, like, actual therapists, they mainly just bumble at you and say things that don't make sense. And
you know, that's what you just said makes actual, like, perfect sense, that we don't want to be psychoanalyzed, because we have so many out-of-work psychologists in this country.
Exactly. But, like, I mean, and you can see that in the episode It's Only a Pale Moon, where she keeps trying to counsel Nog, and she keeps failing so badly. And in the end, like, Vic has to counsel Nog because she's so bad at it.
The hologram.
And in fact, they have another episode, After Image, which is specifically about her being a bad counselor when she tries to counsel Garrick. And in the end, like, she does finally kind of help him, but it's more... I'd almost argue it's the other way around. I'd almost argue that Garrick is counseling her, even though he's the one having horrible claustrophobic issues. And then, like, even more so, her reasons for staying on the station are incredibly flimsy. Like, she basically says, hey, I'm going to stay on the station, and then never really explains why. And it flies in the face of everything that the Trill believe in when it comes to switching hosts. They're all about, like, moving on from the previous life. And her thing is that she's being overwhelmed by all these memories that are really strong of Jadzia. And then they never really effectively establish why she'd be willing to stay, despite all that. It seems like it would have been incredibly logical for her to leave. Mm-hmm. It just would have fit better. And I honestly wish that instead of bringing the Dax symbiont back, I wish they had just brought in another science officer. Because it's not like they needed an excuse. The DS9 needed a science officer. They would have just sent a replacement. And then they could
have... Would they have operated any better, though? Because I think if you brought in a wholly new character that had no attachment to the Dax character in any way, they just would have been a cardboard cutout at that point. Because that one season isn't really going to be enough, unless you focus on that character for the entirety of the season, which they really couldn't because they had, like, the Dominion War arc going on that was wrapping up in the 7th season.
That's true.
You're not going to get a whole lot out of that character.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they could have worked around it. I mean, we wouldn't have had... She wouldn't have been a great character, assuming it's a she, but neither is Ezri. I mean, Ezri is a passable character, but she's not great, and I feel like she did some damage to, like, the established canon on Trill. And I feel like they could have brought in the Dax symbiont as a guest star at some point. Had he or she show up later and be the focus of one episode.
I think that would have felt really disjointed.
Really? You think so?
Yeah, because it's like, oh man, Dax is here! Yeah! I think that kind of would have stolen the show as well.
That's a possibility. I don't know.
And thus reinforcing the fact that whoever this other mystery character that would have been brought in, like you're putting forward, would have just been shadowed over again. You know, it's just like...
I don't know. I'll admit that this is not an easy issue to solve, but...
I think I would have just gone with straight up Dax is dead, let's not replace her, period. That's what I would have gone with, I think, like Ron Moore.
Well, you know, like Ira Stephen Burr is the one who probably would have made that decision as the showrunner. I don't know that for a fact, but I think that's who it would have been. All right, so I think we're about done with DS9, so we are now going to play some music, and when we get back, we will talk a little bit about Voyager before we have to wrap up for the night.
But not about Tom Paris, though.
No, not about Tom Paris.
But he can do everything, though.
He can, but he cannot be talked about on our show.
All right, here's a little Eric Prydz, Call on Me. And we're back here at All Things Trek. We got a lot of stuff to talk about still. It's actually kind of amazing how much stuff we got here. I didn't think that we'd have so much.
Well, you know, we just generated too much content. We're going to finish up next week.
Are we?
I think that's what we're going to have to do. But for now, I think we got time for one of the characters from Voyager. And I think we're going to start with Captain Janeway. Played by Kate Mulgrew. Which was originally one of the show's big claim to fame, which is going to be, look, we're going to have a woman captain.
We're going to have a woman captain, despite Starfleet Reg saying they can't have female captains.
Especially. It's going to be the first of its kind. It's going to be big. It's going to be cool. And then, of course, instead we got Janeway, who starts off the show very poorly in the pilot episode, first by establishing that she's very insecure about her position when she gives Harry a hard time for calling her sir, even though it's been established in canon that you can refer to female officers as sir.
That's just naval tradition, right?
Yeah, I think so. And then she gives him even more of a hard time when he says ma'am, and she's like, no, you have to call me captain. I need to be constantly reminded of my rank. Because I still can't believe I have it. Why would you start off a character that way? Especially a character who's supposed to be, like, your big breakout character. Of, like, look, this is something no one's ever done before. And then they take it a step further, where they establish that she's completely incompetent. By having the whole thing where she blows up the array to stop them from getting home. Instead of just, like, setting a bomb on it with a timer. Which is, you know, this has been hashed through by Star Trek fans, so it's not like I'm bringing up a new point here, but it remains to be said that that is not the best way to introduce us to the new captain.
By eliminating the only way that they can get home once they've established that they're in the Delta Quadrant.
Mm-hmm. And in a way that, you know, with a very little amount of critical thinking, you could find your way around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest problem...
Yeah, here you go. Raffles telling me that military tradition would be ma'am.
Yeah, that makes sense. But either way, she doesn't deal with either one. She has to be called captain. And, like, either way, the biggest problem with Janeway, I think, is that she is in a position where she has to effectively execute the plot. Like, very often the plot stems from what she does, so she has to make decisions based not on in-universe rationale, but on what will cause the most conflict. And if you look at this, that's ended up happening over and over again with Janeway's decisions. Like, her decision to blow up the array she makes this decision not because it's the most logical decision, but because it is the decision that will allow them to have a show. And then look at her decision to fly through Borg space, which is sort of an absurd decision when you think about it, but is
well, they found that Northwest Passage that was full of 8472.
That was super safe.
Well, they didn't know they were there until they were in the passage.
No, but they knew that there was some reason the Borg were staying away from it.
Well, they didn't care what, though.
Plus, exactly. I mean, like, at that point, it was just sort of like, she made this decision because they needed to have a reason for there to be a Borg adventure. And then the same thing with... the episode where they go to the planet that's about to blow itself up with, like, Polaric energy, and she orders Paris not to do anything, because if they just warned them and shut down the horrible energy reactor, that wouldn't have been a very interesting episode. And then they get to the episode where they meet the Ferengi, who have been trapped in the Delta Quadrant, and she decides...
I thought that was an awesome tie-in.
You know, it was an awesome tie-in, but it was poorly handled. Because she goes... Janeway flies in the face of all of her previous decisions, which have been strict interpretations of the Prime Directive, and switches over to, we're going to find a loophole that allows us to intervene, because I don't like Ferengi, as opposed to save an entire race from extinction. You know, she wasn't willing to bend the Prime Directive then, but she's willing to bend it to, like, stop some guys who are, you know, ripping some people off. What? Why? How does Janeway prioritize things? And again, you can see that the answer is that she makes a decision based on what is going to make the plot go. And that is where her decisions come from. And that is a problem with Janeway. And it has to do with the writers not really thinking their plots through very well. And then, of course...
You don't think that perhaps maybe it's just a struggle of her, like, Starfleet, like, ethical, philosophical training coming up against the harsh reality that, like, they're in the Delta Quadrant and there may be no way home?
Nope, and let me tell you why. It's because in those episodes where she makes these decisions, she has no conflict most of the time. There are a couple of exceptions. There is the episode... I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it's the one where they have an option of buying, like, technology on the black market that might help them get home. And in that instance, Janeway actually is conflicted. She actually doesn't know what is the right course of action. On the one hand, she has her Starfleet principal saying it's wrong to buy technology on the black market from a species that doesn't want to share technology with you. On the other hand, she knows that if she does, she can get her crew home. And in that episode, they actually do it. But most of the time, she is completely certain. Like when she orders Paris not to warn the people who are going to be destroyed by their horrible reactor, she is completely certain. There is no doubt in her mind. And then the same thing with the Ferengi. She never doubts if she's doing the right thing. And her character isn't very consistent because of that. And she kind of waffles back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Bra. Welcome to the IRC.
Hello, welcome. We enjoy having people in our IRC.
I'm waving at you. You should wave back. Let me know.
Waving over the internet radios.
It's true.
And then, like, Janeway is also... Like, her most distinguished feature is that she is, like, excessively aggressive. If you have, like, if you look at Janeway, if you want, like, one, like, continuous character trait of hers, that the only one that she really has is her aggressiveness. And, like, having an aggressive captain is fine. Sisko was a fairly aggressive captain. But Janeway just takes it so far out of proportions to the point where she seems kind of unstable.
Really?
Like, I mean, and only once do they really address that, and that's in the episode with the Equinox. I think that's just called Equinox, where she's like going.
That's with, there's like this tiny little Nova class like science ship like on the Delta Quadrant,
which
as well.
They like completely retconned and were like, no, they totally lost another ship in that area. Totally happened.
Well, Starfleet didn't know what happened out in the Badlands. It's just like, ships are gone. They probably got destroyed by the plasma storms.
No, but they established in an earlier episode that there were no records of ships going missing in that area. In the episode where they get where Seska attacks them and steals a transporter,
where this really gnarly plasma storms, really?
Yep.
Huh.
They establish it. They say it. Tuvok has a line where he establishes it. So you know, retcon.
Interesting. I'll have to watch that.
Also, even though Voyager and the Equinox are traveling along the same course, they never like ran into any aliens who had ever seen another Starfleet ship. Which you think they would have, especially since the Equinox was apparently much less constrained by their Starfleet morals than Voyager was, and went.
Well, yeah, they had like captured aliens that were like fueling the ship or something, weren't they?
And in that episode, Janeway goes completely crazy on them, and it's just like vendetta. It's like, I'm going to kill Captain Ransom. It's not just I'm going to stop what he's doing. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to turn him and his crew over to the aliens and let them be killed. And at least in that episode, they acknowledge that she is going too far, and Chakotay actually has to stand up and say, hey, this is too far. But he doesn't do anything about it. He just tells her that she's going too far. Mm-hmm. And then basically that's it. And then they kind of don't really resolve it, but they at least acknowledge it. Most of the time, no one ever, like, points out to her that she's being really... Like, she's being kind of unstable. She just seems to love making decisions based on what will cause the most conflict, like I said earlier, as opposed to what will actually, you know, make sense for her character to make decisions from in-universe reasoning. Like, in the episode where she decides not to help the robots.
The robots.
This is also kind of a Torres episode, where they find a robot that's floating through space, and, like, Torres becomes, like, super, like, obsessed with it for really no reason.
Is that one called Dreadnought?
No, Dreadnought is the one where they find out that that Torres made an invincible missile. Or she modified a Cardassian missile to be invincible. No, this was a different one. I don't remember the name of it, but like basically, they find this robot, and the robot's part of a race of robots, and he's like, we can't make more robots. Can you help us make more robots? And Janeway says, no, we won't help you. And basically,
just cause
she doesn't know anything about their situation, she just refuses on principle. It's not like, well, tell us more about you, and then maybe we'll help. It's no, because it would be wrong to interfere. And like,
just because it'd be wrong to interfere, there was no like maybe mention of like they don't have the resources to populate a robot race.
No, they could do it very easily. It wasn't that they needed to build more robots. It was that they needed to correct an error in the robot's programming that prevented them from repopulating themselves. And then, of course, later in the episode, we find out that, ooh, it's because the robots killed their creators and are now fighting a war with other robots. But we didn't know that at the time. Like, Janeway didn't know that when she made her decision. And she basically, she made her decision because it was, you know, because this was Janeway sticking to, like, because this put Janeway into conflict with Torres, where if she had been more reasonable about it and been like, well, you're a sentient race asking for help, as Starfleet, you'd think Starfleet would be interested in helping, since we know Starfleet are, you know, pretty benevolent as an organization.
A humanitarian armada, as Bruce Greenwood says.
you might even say that. And, you know, it seems weird that she was completely unwilling to help these people. Really for no reason other than to interfere is wrong. And that's something that, again, you see that as a recurring theme with Janeway, but then in other times she completely ignores the Prime Directive and is like, we're going to do this.
Are they sort of in a particular order? Like, you see her obeying the Prime Directive earlier in the series, and then later on she's not? Or is it really just random, how do I feel today?
It's a little bit more common later in the series, when they actually had a little bit of a better grip on her character, but in the early episode, she kind of waffles back and forth. Like the Ferengi episode is pretty early. It's not like, it's pre-7 of 9, I think. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure it's pre-7 of 9. So, like, you know, for the first, like, two or three seasons, they're really inconsistent. Oh, Prototype is the episode. Thank you,
Nala.
Nala from the IRC. Prototype is the episode with the robots that she refuses to help. You know, because robots are lame, I guess. Janeway hates robots. Maybe she and Pulaski went to the same school.
Ooh! Sick burn.
But, like, that's, you know, that is Janeway's, like, main problem, is that she is just, she's not consistent. And the few traits that she is consistent on are the ones where she's making decisions that cause problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, I do really like Kate Mulgrew.
She's a fantastic actor.
Yeah, she's very good. And she's actually really good for the part. Like, if they had Janeway as a more consistent character, who was a captain who was maybe a little bit, you know, on the aggressive side of things...
Is it a bad thing Janeway is your favorite captain?
Yes. No, I'm not going to say that who anyone should like or dislike. I'm just saying my own opinions, and I'm not saying that it's, you know, that you can't like a character that I dislike.
I'd be interested in hearing, though, why she's your favorite captain, though, Ankiel.
Yeah, if you want to, if anyone
in the IRC or through our email, which you can all email us at allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
Yeah, we would, you know, I love to hear people who disagree with me, and, you know, I like to talk with them and, you know, see what they think and why they think it.
It makes them rage so hard.
It does. Rage. But Kate Mulgrew is a very talented actress, and she could have been very, very good for the part if they had written her better. And that's the other thing, is that this is the other thing that annoys me about Janeway, is that a lot of people really complain. I've heard a lot of people complain about her voice. And I don't understand what's wrong with her voice. It's kind of a deep, it's a little gravelly, I guess, but...
I think she's got a good command voice.
Yeah, I feel like
her voice, she can bellow with the best of them.
I feel like she's fine for that, and I don't understand why people complained about it so much. But it's a very constant complaint that I've heard among people who don't like Voyager, is that they complain about...
They don't like her voice.
They don't like her... It does. I mean, even SF Debris, who was a really good Star Trek reviewer, loves to complain about her voice. Although usually, at least he's usually joking, I'll admit that, but like a lot of people I know are just, you know, are not seriously, you know, are not joking about it. They do not like Kate Mulgrew's voice, which I think is just a really weird thing to latch on to.
Maybe they just don't like female Star Trek characters.
Maybe they don't. I don't know.
I want to get to Enterprise real quick before we wrap up.
Okay, I'm going to skip to Enterprise real quick.
Yeah.
All right, Enterprise is...
Because I think Enterprise has probably two of the most polarized female main cast members.
Enterprise gets a failing grade on female cast members.
Gosh, it does.
Voyager at least gets an E for effort. at least with Voyager, they were trying. They weren't doing a very good job, but in Enterprise, they just gave up, and they were like, nope, we're done. We're not even going to try anymore.
F+.
People like Seven of Nine because she, you know, had ample bosoms. We're going to put that back in, except we're not going to attach a cool character to it. We're just going to have T'Pol, who is the worst Vulcan ever. No, she's the second worst Vulcan ever. The worst Vulcan ever is T'Pol's mom, who we meet in one episode. Suddenly, T'Pol makes so much sense when you meet her mom.
I'll have to watch that one.
You should. But, I mean, Enterprise in general was really bad to Vulcans and basically portrayed them all as being huge jerks. And T'Pol, like, worst of all, like, she butts heads constantly with the humans over things that don't matter, and she's, like, really ignorant of human customs. And then there's an episode later where you find out that T'Pol's grandmother, like, crash-landed on Earth and, like, lived among humans for a while and told T'Pol all about humans, and T'Pol tells the crew a story about it. So they actually establish that T'Pol doesn't not understand human customs. She understands them perfectly. She's just being difficult. And it's just like, oh my goodness, why? And then, of course, on the other end of the spectrum, we have Hoshi Sato, whose only role on the ship is to... She has two roles on the ship. She screams, and she points a thing at people. Like, they originally had her on because they were like, look, this is before the... this is before the Universal Translator, right? So we're going to have...
Right, she was like a linguist.
Yeah, she was supposed to be a linguist who knew, like, 40 languages, because no one on television understands how hard it is to learn a language.
She knew, like, a whole... Like, the majority of them on Earth. If I remember this right, she knew the majority of them on Earth.
Something right? like that. But she knew a lot of languages. And they were like, we need a linguist because our Universal Translator doesn't work right. But then they established that really all you have to do with the Universal Translator, even in Enterprise, is point it at them until it starts translating.
Just keep talking
like,
at the
stick. That's all that she does. That's her entire job on the ship. And she's afraid of everything. She hates space. She hates aliens. She hates confined spaces, all of things.
She gets space sick too.
Yeah, all of these things you are going to find on a spaceship. And it's like, you could literally, if they had built a robot whose only job it was to follow the captain around with the Universal Translator and point it at aliens, it would have done a better job than Hoshi Sato does.
Man, Enterprise robot would have been rad.
Yeah.
And it would have been like, what's the name of the show? Lost in Space? What was the name of that robot?
I don't know, Danger Will Robinson.
Because that's the one I'm seeing, but it's got like the Starfleet, it was the United Earth patch or whatever it was. It was Starfleet.
Yeah, it was Starfleet, but it wasn't the Federation yet. And then, of course, and like Linda Park is actually not a bad actress. And there was like one moment in like the entire show where she's cool, and that's in Countdown, where, like, the Zindi, like, capture her to decrypt something, and she actually, like, encrypts it more. And, you know, resists, like, the torture that they're putting on her, which was actually cool.
The Mirror Universe!
Yeah, she in the Mirror Universe episode. She was actually pretty
cool. Thank you,
Barra. Thank you. No, that was Nala.
No, that was Barra.
Was it?
Oh, wait.
Yeah. It was Nala. I was totally right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so she...
I'm sorry, so Nala. I didn't mean to
do
that.
As Nala points out, it was, in fact, she was cool in the Mirror Universe episode.
Because she was so awesome in the Mirror Universe, that just reinforces the fact that her mirror...
That her regular universe self is so awful.
That her prime universe self is just a wuss.
Universe prime.
Because she was plotting and conniving.
Mm-hmm. And then it was even weirder. In the fourth season, they gave the show to a completely different writer and tried to fix some of the problems. And he established that she knew kung fu, and that she had like been thrown out of the academy for breaking her instructor's arm. But like that was so at odds with what everything else they'd established about her that it just felt really weird. It was like, wait, she knows kung fu, and you just look at all these fist fights that she's been in and hasn't done anything. She just kind of cowers in the corner when there's a fist fight. And it's like, if she knows kung fu, why isn't she in there mixing it up? You can't just add kung fu onto
the arm break
character.
I think might have been an accident at that point, because I mean, you know, because no, maybe no, she's they, got that performance anxiety.
No, the arm
can't...
break thing is separate. Like, they established first that she knows kung fu, and then they established that she was thrown out of the academy for breaking her instructor's arm. Not her kung fu instructor, like a teacher was giving her a hard time and she broke his arm.
I'm not sure I want her on my crew.
Yeah, I know, right? And that was their attempt to give her some more character. But it just was so... It was too little too late is what it was.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, Enterprise doesn't get any of the breaks that I give some of the other series. Like, it's not in the 60s, so it doesn't get the excuse of, this was just a sexist or time. and it wasn't Voyager, where they were at least trying to have more interesting female characters. They just did not care in Enterprise.
They just didn't care.
They were just done. And they were like, we're going to put in some sex appeal, and then we're going to put in a lady who screams, and that's going to be our entire show. It's going to be the entirety of our female cast.
Well, why do you think those choices were made, then, to have those kinds of characters? Not just an Enterprise, but the entirety of the Star Trek series having these female characters that are bad like that. Do you think it's just the writer's fault, or because the story was written in such a way?
In each series, it was a separate thing. In the original series, it was because of the 60s and the attitude of... especially of the attitude that the networks thought people had when watching television. In Next Generation, it was simply because the writers didn't know how to handle Troy's abilities.
Because they're so OP.
Yeah, so they gave her these abilities and didn't know what to do with them. DS9 had great female characters, so, you know, A+. Mm-hmm. Voyager, it was just a case of they couldn't be consistent, and they didn't give their other characters enough depth. And then, although Voyager does have 7 of 9, and even though 7 of 9 is really blatant sexual pandering, it is at least a good character attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Enterprise, I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I think Rick Berman had just decided by that point that people would watch Star Trek no matter what they did. So they just tried to appeal to, like, the basest, lowest common denominator with these two characters.
Yeah.
That's what I think happened. I'm not positive.
Rick Berman, not my favorite.
No, you will not find Rick Berman fans here.
Is he still employed by Paramount?
He is, but he's not in this part of the Star Trek series franchise anymore.
Eh?
I think he's... I don't know what he's doing now, but he is officially off Star Trek forever.
Officially off Star Trek forever.
Which we can all be thankful for.
What would you want to see out of a new... What would be your ideal female character if they did another series?
I'd really like to see another female captain, one who wasn't lame. You know, that
Rachel Garrett comes to mind.
Yeah,
Enterprise C.
You know my secret, Bob, is that I would really love to have a series about the Enterprise.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that.
I have. I'm a huge Star Trek fan, so I've actually written a few episodes of what that would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to have that, but I don't think that's what they're going to do. Yeah. I don't know if they will ever make another Star Trek series. But if they do, I would like to see a female captain. Barring that, a female first officer would be okay. And I would like her to be. I would really like her to be an alien that makes her look less human. Because even DS9, basically, Kira and Dax were still very attractive, human-looking women. Dax had some spots, Kira had a funny nose. I would really like to see... a woman character in makeup that makes her look... That basically removes her as eye candy. Like, she's an alien that we cannot look at and say, that's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would like. And I don't know if we will ever get that because of television and appealing to the lowest common denominator. But I want that. I want that to happen.
Do you have anything left to talk about?
No, I think...
As a female?
Cast
members?
We had to skip over a couple of Voyager cast
members. We did, because we're pressed for time.
But, you know, I don't think we have time to go into them.
We don't, unfortunately. Maybe a little bit in the future.
Yeah, if we can... We might come back to some of them. But I hope you guys all enjoyed this, especially the first episode of Tales from the DMZ.
Oh yeah, we'll have more coming up. It's a little bit of a lengthy editing process, adding all the sound effects and such in, but we'll definitely have more for you guys coming up. What are we talking about next week?
I'm not sure what we're going to talk about next week.
I want to talk about Tom Paris.
You want to talk about Tom Paris?
I do want to talk about Tom Paris. For 2 hours, I want to talk about Tom Paris.
I don't know if we can do 2 hours, but we will talk about Tom Paris next week.
All right, we'll do a Voyager marathon with just Tom Paris.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
I know you might not be able to handle it, necessarily.
I think I'm going to overdose on Voyager.
All right, guys. You've been listening to All Things Trek here on Rise Radio. I'm DJ Bob.
And I'm DJ Oren.
All right, you guys. Have a good day, and remember, keep on trekking.
Oh, and who's coming on after us?
I believe it's DJ Earl that's doing a section. Here, I know Rockwell's not here, because he's got, actually, his web is on the fritz and mm-hmm. such, so he's not going to be here today for his block, unfortunately, but he's got some other DJs who are also really awesome filling with him. I know Earl's going to be on, Roxy, I think, is also going to be in there as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got awesome music selections.
They do.
I love Earl's stuff.
So stay tuned for those guys, because they're rad.
Yeah. All right, you guys, you have a fantastic day, and this is Riser Radio.